You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson spent 32 years at Goldman Sachs, so it should come as no surprise that he tapped some of his former colleagues there to head up the $700 billion bailout. Although Goldman Sachs has enjoyed a reputation as the premier investment bank in America, even it was not immune from the recent flood of bad news. To make sense of all the changes and whether the leadership of Goldman veterans should build confidence in the prospect of a full recovery, we have invited Charles D. Ellis to join us. He has been a consultant to Goldman for more than 30 years. And he's written a book called The Partnership, The Making of Goldman Sachs, which is published by Penguin. I'm very pleased it has brought Charles D. Ellis to the show today. Hello.
Hi. I'd be more comfortable if you call me Charlie, but your
okay,
choice.
Okay, Charlie. A lot of Americans no longer feel that they can trust anyone associated with Wall Street. Should Goldman Sachs be exempt from those fears?
If you're going to be categorical and overwhelming, I guess the answer is nobody should be exempt.
Because, you know, we keep on hearing it's Wall Street versus Main Street.
Dreadfully wrong statement. The full statement
It should be Elm Street, actually, shouldn't it?
Well, the full statement is $700 billion Wall Street bailout. And then you get each one of those words is wrong. It's not a $700 billion. It's an investment of up to $700 billion. There'd be some real assets behind that, and they may even make a profit on it. And it's not a bailout, and it is not a solution for Wall Street. It's a solution for Main Street.
Although not everyone agrees. There are economists out there like Joseph Stiglitz who think it's a big mistake. So we'll find out in how many years whether this has all worked out okay or not?
I think you'll know an awful lot a year from now, but I would wait 5 years for sure.
Now, you've been a consultant at Goldman Sachs for 30 years. Doesn't that suggest it might be difficult for you to be unbiased in your assessment of the history of this institution?
It could be. It could be. I was at the same time a consultant for 30 years to Morgan Stanley and for 30 years to Merrill Lynch and for 30 years to Solomon Brothers, and or 25 years to Solomon Brothers, and a whole bunch of other firms. Never, ever dependent on Goldman Sachs, and it was one of many clients, but it was my favorite client because I thought they were the most interesting bunch.
So you're not surprised that some of the others have gone under?
I'm surprised, but if you had told me you got to pick and choose, who do you think is going to make it through the worst of the worst? I'd have picked Goldman Sachs immediately.
Well, Goldman has done very well during this crisis, but didn't it play a part in it by peddling subprime securities, saving itself at the same time sensing that the market was turning and making a mint betting house prices would drop?
It's a nice straight question, but as anybody would expect, you've got two things completely combined, and I think you really have to separate them. In order to understand, you may then want to put them back together.
Well,
anyway.
I was saying they were playing both ends against the middle to some degree.
Well, they were an underwriter in substantial volume, as all other firms were, of subprime mortgages packaged into securities. And no doubt about that. A separate group within the organization was running the book as to what they should be doing. And
so one side wasn't telling the other, because we have a situation where a company that prides itself on client relations is also selling subprime securities while essentially betting against them.
Yeah. Now you're getting to the real heart of what I think is a really interesting question. It's so complicated, I'm not sure anybody will be able to understand it. But the basic proposition is this. Anybody who is worldwide has got 35,000 really smart people working their tails off to do transactions all over the place in all sorts of different markets is going to have conflicts of interest. That's a given. So now the question is, are you going to stand back and try to avoid those? You can't. How about trying something else? What? Manage them. Try to understand them. Tell your clients what you're going to do, what your policies are, how you're going to do it, and be straightforward.
So some of the other companies that have been hurt just didn't create that kind of balance. They didn't protect themselves. They just were too heavily into one rather than the other.
I think that's probably fair. But it is obviously much more interesting and complicated for that. They would like to know all the details. You could go on for hours and hours.
But again, we come back to this question. Why should Americans feel any sense of confidence in the people working on this? We're not going to call it a bailout. You said I shouldn't call it a bailout. When so many of them come from an institution that played a part in getting us into this mess.
Well, you remember Joe Kennedy, being appointed chairman of the SEC and Franklin Roosevelt's wonderful summary statement, to catch a thief.
It's like they say that half of the bad guys from a neighborhood become cops and the other half become criminals.
I've heard that too, yeah. But what you really need is expertise. And my own very strong view, as I've known these guys over years and years and years, is that they are the best bag of really straight-ahead, trustworthy, honest, unbelievable, not Boy Scouts in the sense of being prissy, but they play by the rules, play hardball, but they play by the rules.
When you say the best, is that because Goldman Sachs hires differently than other investment firms?
They sure do.
And what are the rules that they have?
Well, first is that they do not hire in the top quartile like everybody else. And then you say, well, you mean you hire in the top decile? They say, no, not really the top decile. And then you know you've got a question. Okay, what do you do? We hire in the top 5% from the principal graduate schools, mostly in business, but in physics and in mathematics and economics all over the country and all around the world. Okay, so you get the top 5%. Then what do? We sort them out. We watch very closely to see how well they do in doing our kind of work and playing by our very important commitment to teamwork. And are they really skilled at what they're doing, and can they play it straight? And anybody who gets off the right track, out they go. Anybody who's not sufficiently skillful or commercial, out they go. Anybody who doesn't believe in teamwork, out they go. And then you're down to the 2 or 3% best out of the 5% selected. Go from there.
But that also means, since you're picking from such a small group to start with, that salaries have to be higher than at other places.
Starting salaries aren't particularly higher, but the word is out among young people that if you do well at Goldman Sachs, you'll do very well financially. But that's often not the driving force.
My guest is Charles D. Ellis, whose book, The Partnership, The Making of Goldman Sachs, is published by the Penguin Press. Well, there are these 10 commandments that they have to live by. I have to tell you, I looked at them and I thought, this is not very profound. If we're talking about the top 5 percentile from the top universities of America, having to learn things like, you never learn anything when you're talking. The respect of one person is worth more than acquaintance with 100. This almost sounds like Chairman Mao's red book.
Well, you have to understand the context. There was a 12-item set of profound principles.
There's nothing worse than an unhappy client.
Yeah.
I have to tell somebody that?
All of us have to be reminded to brush our teeth. All of us have to be reminded to stay at the speed limit. All of us have to be reminded to vote. All of us have to be reminded to say thank you, Mom. All of us are learning creatures. But that came up in a context, and the context was the 12 principles that John White had put together. He also tossed on the table, here are 10 commandments that will guide you when you're out there trying to do and develop business. He didn't think of them as profound. He thought them as things everybody ought to do all the time.
And John Whitehead a key figure? Because he came in way after the company was founded.
Yeah. You can argue that Goldman Sachs was founded in the 1860s. You could also argue that Goldman Sachs was refounded in the early 1930s. And I think that's probably more accurate. John Whitehead was one of the people recruited by the legendary Sidney Weinberg to come in and become an assistant to Sidney Weinberg and then become an investment banker.
It was founded by Marcus Goldman, a Jewish immigrant from Bavaria.
Yep.
And it was just a small commercial paper dealer at the time.
Well, it was smaller than that. It was what he could put in his stovepipe hat in the lining in pieces of paper that he would collect IOUs. Now we would call them commercial paper, but they were such small amounts that we wouldn't dignify it with the name commercial paper today. And then he would take these small IOUs uptown 10 blocks to the banks, where he would sell them to the banks, and get the cash, and go back down and lend the money to the guys working in the garment district in the meat cutting business.
Yesterday, the Fed began to buy up some of the commercial paper on the street. It's been touted as an unprecedented move. Why?
Presumably because it hasn't been done before.
Because the government is buying it instead of people like Marcus Goldman or whoever is big in the business these days.
Yeah, the commercial paper volume is huge, and the number of dealers in it is relatively small, but there are also major corporations like GE, GM, Ford that deal as individuals directly into the market.
Now, this has been a rocky ride for Goldman Sachs. It's now the most profitable and the most respected, but there was a Ponzi-like misadventure that unraveled in the 1929 crash. It survived?
Just barely. After that, they went for 14 years with an average profit of zero.
But survived it. Well, but that was the Depression. I guess that was – the excuse
help.
Was it's the Depression.
Depression didn't help at all, but it was a long, tough slog, and there were a small group of people left at the end.
And then
scrappy.
Then there was the Penn Central debacle.
Yep. 1970, the largest railroad in the country and the largest landowner in the country, Penn Central, which was a combination of the Pennsylvania Railroad and the New York Central. One small problem, those two cultures were people who hated each other and had always fought against each other. So you try to jam them together. I suppose you could merge Harvard and Yale together, you would have a tough time getting them all to follow the same rules and things.
But we see mergers of investment banks constantly. Do we see the same kinds of problems?
No, every time you see a merger of an investment bank, I can promise you, you're seeing two tribal cultures come together and they go immediately to war, and one of those cultures wins out over the other culture, and it's not nice.
Mm-hmm. So the same sort of – because there's too much duplication or there's just two different philosophies at work, I would assume that the one, the dominant one, would win. In other words, if Goldman Sachs buys Lehman Brothers – I'm just making that up. But, you know, then Goldman Sachs automatically has the upper hand, doesn't it?
Who is dominant is not a matter of how big you are. It's how virulent and – aggressive and combative you can be. When Phibro and took over Salomon Brothers, it was like an acquisition. Less than 5 years later, everybody in Phibro was basically out, and the management of Salomon Brothers was in.
But they were the ones who had caused all the trouble in the first place.
That's a different era.
Ah.
That's a different era. But this combination of securities firms is just a repetitive thing every single time. One culture is more devoted to winning, harder working, faster paced, more skillful, whatever you want to call it, all those things together, and they do finally prevail over the others. And no merger has ever been a merger. They've always been a takeover, one way or another.
As recently as the 1990s, there were two market quakes, and they left Goldman Sachs severely shaken, didn't they?
You're talking about 94?
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't ask for a rougher, more forceful negative experience. They'd had a wonderful run in 92 and then did spectacularly in 93. So they weren't prepared for some of the kinds of violent negative experiences they went through. But yeah, 94 was terrible.
But was it worse for them than this current situation?
Because this
is being touted as the worst since 1929.
Well, it's the worst financial panic, crisis, discombobulation, a whole bunch of other things. And clearly on a scale and intensity and global and complexity, it's right up there. It is completely different from 29 also.
Well, there's no run on the banks, and we have all these insurance and other safeguards in place to prevent a 1929. But it seems but a lot of people are going to lose a lot of money.
We have lost a lot of money. I wouldn't want to forecast what's going to happen from here one way or the other, but I bet you that what's already happened is the largest fraction of anything that's going to happen.
I'm so grateful I have no money to lose. Charles D. Ellis is the author of 14 books, including Winning the Loser's Game, Capital, the biography of Joe Wilson. His latest is called The Partnership, The Making of Goldman Sachs, published by Penguin Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Coming up a bit later in this hour, Isaac Mizrahi gives tips on how we can all learn to have great style no matter what your age, shape, or budget. In our second hour, State of the Union is all about New Hampshire. And then the gurus of how-to will be here, Al and Larry Ubell, answering your home repair questions. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Now our entire show is available as a podcast. We're back with Charles D. Ellis. His latest book, his 14th, is called The Partnership, The Making of Goldman Sachs, published by the Penguin Press. And Mr. Ellis has such a long list of accomplishments that I'm reluctant to go through them all because then I won't get a chance to talk to you about other things. But one of 11 individuals honored for lifetime contributions to the investment profession. Academic activities include two appointments to the faculty of the Harvard Business School and to the Yale School of Management, and et cetera, et cetera. And also, for a while, you were at WGBH in Boston. So you also have a radio background?
WYBC, Yale Broadcasting Corporation at Yale, was where I really sank my teeth in. We had 3 years of working together and put together a wonderful bunch of guys.
Back to Goldman Sachs. Yeah. Warren Buffett recently rescued it. Is rescue the right word?
No,
with the $5 billion cash infusion?
It's not the right word. It's an important investment.
$5 billion isn't all that much to a company like Goldman Sachs.
Well, it's a lot of money. And it's fresh money and it's equity money. And anybody in his right mind would say, that's a lot of money. But I don't think that means rescue.
Well, they also...
Were they glad to have it? Sure they were.
And I'm sure they were glad to have his praise. And then September 24th, they found other investors to snap up $5 billion more of its stock. So it needed $10 billion. Is that enough to stabilize it?
I'm not an expert, and I don't know the details of their financial position, but I do know from observation they do smart things, and I would bet that they've got plenty of reserves in that 10.
But obviously,
you've got to be fair. I'm just a book writer, in all fairness.
Yeah, but you have inside knowledge there, and I'm sure you've spoken to some people.
Not about this specific, because they would, as a public company, they wouldn't talk to anybody, and particularly somebody who would come on your wonderful program.
Market forces recently pushed Lloyd Blankfein, the current CEO of Goldman Sachs, to agree that the investment bank business model no longer works. So as a result, hasn't Goldman Sachs become a bank holding company?
It has indeed.
How does that affect the way it conducts its business, or will conduct its business?
Well, there are a couple of things that are pretty obvious. One is that it's, quote unquote, a bank holding company. The second thing, it would be regulated by the Fed. Third is that there will be a group of regulators on deck all the time watching and studying each individual component, probably be something like most of the banks that are sizable, run between 50 and 100 regulators in the organization, being sure they've got the right factual information.
Now, for years, all of these companies have been fighting like mad being regulated by the Fed. Are they comfortable with this prospect? Or do they see as no other – right now, is there any other option?
I think that's closer, that this is a very realistic way of going. But you have to keep in mind, I think as you look at the issues right now, that it's less than 10 years ago, they were in final negotiations with J.P. Morgan, then arguably the world's best bank, about combining. And the Morgan board was going to meet within a week, and the Goldman Sachs board was going to meet within a week, and they'd finished 3 months of due diligence discussions, and they'd found all kinds of interesting things, and many people thought it was a really good idea. Hank Paulson went home, as he told his group he was going to do, studied all the data, and came back early the next morning and said, we're not going to do this deal.
Because of the regulation aspect?
No. The real problem was 9 to 5. Goldman Sachs people come in around 6:45, 7 o'clock, and they're hard at work from then on till 10, 11 o'clock at night. They work Saturdays and Sundays having discussion groups. They work all the time. And they learned that the guys at the Morgan Bank really believed in 9 to 5, and they thought it was silly to do more than 9 to 5, and they sure as the dickens didn't work on weekends.
But J.P. Morgan Chase is one of the banks that's come out of this thing in pretty good shape.
Jamie Dimon has done a terrific job as chief executive, and they've combined two organizations.
So are they coming in earlier? Are they coming into work earlier than they used to?
I would bet, particularly ones that are still there.
It is interesting to see who was vulnerable in the past and who is it so much about who's running the company at any given moment?
I think chief executives play a very important role, but I honestly believe deeply that history plays by far the most important role. History shows up as what we like to call culture, the way we do things here, who we are, what we're all about.
For example, when Mr. Fuld appeared before Congress the other day, he seemed to feel that he had done nothing wrong, despite the fact that there was a debacle. Shouldn't he be held responsible for what happened at his company?
Again, you're asking a very precise question. I'd like to give you a precise answer. I don't know enough to give you a precise answer.
But you have a sense of the way these companies work.
Yeah, I do know that Dick Fuld had a wonderful long career of rebuilding Lehman Brothers. He did a terrific job year after year after year. Many, many people thought he was just terrific. Those same people would say today, wow, I didn't realize how serious some of those problems were. Should he have known? Absolutely. Did he know? I don't know.
Well, because as you suggested earlier, some of these companies are so big that one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing.
They're big, complex, and the world in which they are working is going very, very fast in lots and lots and lots and lots of different directions. It's amazing how complicated these organizations are to manage.
And we have noticed in the past, for example, a trader in Asia, I've forgotten, what was it, in Shanghai or Singapore?
Singapore.
Who practically brought down a bank by himself simply by being a reckless trader.
He and his supervisor were both, and both guys are at fault. His supervisor and he were both on a very strong incentive bonus compensation. If you shoot the lights out, you'll get rich. He got himself into trouble. He started doubling up his bets, tripling the bets, quadrupling the bets. He multiplied, multiplied, multiplied. Nobody said stop.
Like going to Las Vegas.
Yeah, nobody said stop. And so he finally lost. And Bluey, one of the great banking organizations in the history of London, Baring, out they went.
It's totally dead now?
Bits and pieces are still at work in different places, but the organization, as you and I might have known it at the time, Bluey, gone forever.
And that's why so many of these institutions wind up being sold off in bits and pieces, because there are profitable sides still.
And but wonderfully nobody wants talented people, too.
My guest is Charles D. Ellis. His latest book, The Partnership, The Making of Goldman Sachs, published by the Penguin Press. So you mentioned bonuses. Will the move at Goldman Sachs toward becoming a bank holding company, will that affect the bonus structures that have outraged so many people?
My own personal guess is, first, yes, it'll affect the numbers. Secondly, I don't think they'll be as large in the future as they have been. Secondly, when we get outraged, usually it's because we don't know quite as much as we ought to, and therefore we're surprised by what the numbers are. But are they spectacularly large? Absolutely. And can I justify them for anybody in any circumstances? Don't ask me that question. It's too hard.
The golden parachutes, again, they don't surprise you sometimes, especially when somebody—
Leonard, we're starting to get into something. I really want to—I'm going to be very clear with you. I think the pay levels that have been going to the senior executives have gotten so far out of alignment with any kind of rational or plausible reality that it's an embarrassment. And as a business person myself, it really bothers me.
But it's always been thus, I think. Many years ago, I was an assistant art director at an ad agency, and they lost an account. I was not working on that account, but I was fired and two secretaries. And I asked, why didn't you fire the account executive who blew it? And they said, well, he's a vice president. Eventually, they hired me back because they needed the work done. But that's the way it has always been, hasn't it?
No, that's not true. You know, we fire chief executive officers faster these days than we ever did before.
And then you give them $50 million.
The compensation to cause people to stay at an organization has to be competitive, is the logic train. They compare to all the other companies in the industry and make their comparison and say, we want to have top quartile people, so we ought to be paying top quartile pay. And if my top quartile gets you a raise, and your raise gets me a raise, off we go.
But sometimes it just seems like people are out of touch with reality. The revelations just, was it yesterday that AIG had taken a $440,000 junket at a time when they knew that the business was in serious trouble? You wind up with all the late night talk show hosts making jokes about it.
I can imagine.
Jay Leno, in fact, that he did.
I wish I'd heard.
And then Barack Obama brought it up during the debate yesterday. Yeah. Well, how does that happen? I know you don't know.
I don't know, and I don't know why athletes who are playing a sport that they just love to play get paid unbelievably large amounts of money. Why is it Tiger Woods, who just happens to be a super golfer and a lovely guy, why does he get paid as much as he does? The world is a very complicated place. I was an art history major when I was in school, and I'm amazed at what some artists have been paid. It was a recent auction which had cows in formaldehyde and sharks in formaldehyde and huge. Tell me what the justification is. I don't know.
Getting back to the situation at Goldman Sachs at the end of 2006, its chief financial officer, David Vinier, he ordered the traders to reduce their exposure to mortgage security risk. Now, was Goldman Sachs the only company that recognized that this was a serious exposure, a real problem?
Best I can find, that's accurate, that they were the first and by such a margin that other organizations basically just didn't come to the trade.
And as you tell the story, the traders complained that they didn't know how to do it.
Well, we've got an interesting phenomenon of if you want to be rigorous in managing the financial operation of a securities firm, you mark everything to market. So whatever you own, what's the market price? And they couldn't give an accurate market price. You sell 100 shares, that's one price. Sell 100,000 shares, that's another price. Sell 1,000,000 shares, that's another price. So the question was, what would be the right price? They didn't know for sure. That's when Lloyd Lankfein, who'd been a trader himself, said, easy, sell some. What people will buy, that's the real price.
And then he said, sell 10% of every position.
Yeah, something real. Don't kid me, sell it. And that gives you a price.
And nobody else?
It's called price discovery, and it's a very interesting process. There are times when you really don't know what the right price is. Sell your own home. Mm-hmm. You haven't sold it for 15 or 20 years. You don't know what the right price is, so you check your neighbors, you check the people, and then you say, well, I think I'll ask for a little bit more. And you find it's a little bit less is offered to you, and you gradually figure out what the right price ought to be.
But also, just the realization that they should be selling these things off at a time when the people who were working
that
on them were resistant because they didn't think it was a good idea.
Well, I think there's an even better line to go after, and that is, why didn't the other organizations? And the real answer is, I love Tom Friedman's book, The World is Flat, because it tells you so much about what's really going on. Goldman Sachs is flat. They don't have anything like hierarchy. And it goes all the way back to Gus Levy, who would immediately say to you, if you called him Mr. Levy, he'd say, call me Gus. And if you ever called him Mr. Levy again, he'd look at you as though you're a jerk. Everybody was on a first-name basis. Nobody wore fancy suits. Everybody ate lunch at their desk. Everybody was back and forth all the time. That trend and tradition has carried on with Goldman Sachs. So everybody looks for, who's the guy that knows the most about the issue? I don't care whether he's 23 or 53. Whatever his age, if he's got the most skill, he's the guy we go with. And that's the way in which they made that decision.
And the other houses are more hierarchical?
Much more hierarchical.
Every one of them?
Not every because one you, of them, you know, but most of them, and they tend to get bigger and bigger. The bigger and bigger ones tend to get more and more bureaucratic and layers of management. And then you'll find out that some of the senior executives, honestly, didn't want to hear it. I'm making very high incomes because we're producing great profits and the board's giving me lots of bonuses. I don't want to hear from anybody who's got troubles.
Michael Douglas was here.
Can I just go back on one quick thing?
Yeah, sure.
I think it's helpful. Goldman Sachs is really interested in making profits, no doubt about it. You know what they're more interested in? Risk. They are so interested in finding out what is the risk, what could cause us to get hurt by the risk, and how can we manage it, that the whole organization is risk-focused first, profit focus right after.
And I would have thought that everybody in the business would think that way.
Well, they are today, but it's a little late.
Well, but, you know, we do live in a skewed situation. Michael Douglas told me that he's always stunned when somebody comes up to him and says, Gordon Gekko, you're my hero. You know, he saw that character as a villain.
He's right.
He's right what? The character was a villain, of course. But and greed is good, of course, is an unacceptable position. But many people saw
Keep
it as...
Keep in mind, when you say greed is good, that comes from Ivan Boesky, who was really a bad guy.
And went to jail.
Rightly.
But, you know, I've always wondered about that. If I could go to jail for a couple of years to do one of those nice jails and then come back and know that there's $1 billion waiting for me somewhere in a bank, an offshore bank, I might consider that a good investment.
Think about it.
It's another risk thing.
Yeah. Of course, you need to be sure you're going to get the billion.
Well,
you want
to
be sure
to be okay.
That it's a nice prison. You want to be sure it's just 2 years. Let me play with some of those variables, and I think I could talk you right back out of it.
Charles D. Ellis's latest book is called The Partnership, The Making of Goldman Sachs, published by the Penguin Press. Is another one in the works?
Yes. I want to do a very sober-sided study of the great firms in each of the major professions.
But you do know that right now there are about 100 people at work on the great crash of 2008.
I would assume so.
You wouldn't be interested in doing that.
It's a fascinating subject, but I figure with all those people doing it, why should I want to compete and be one of a large group and not interested? I'd rather find something I could do really, really well and focus on that.
Sounds like an investment firm. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
And thinking about budgets, up next, you can find out how to have great style at any budget because fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi will join me to give us some tips. By the way, you can check out our new Redraw the Electoral Map Challenge. I think you should, actually, and I hope you'll give us your creative take on how this year's electoral map could look differently from the ones in past elections. Just go to our show page at WNYC.org to find out more details.